session number 9927, reel 8.
Lieutenant Colonel Hemsley, reel 8. Yes, you were explaining about the laying of the cables for the Passchendaele battle.
Yes.
Well, what other preparations, you know, did you have to make apart from that?
Well, that was the main one, because you have to bear in mind that the gunners depended upon the information coming back from the observers in the line, and the observers normally had to have a cable run out to them, and sooner or later the cable got cut by shell fire. And so the necessity was that they should always have cable down as far as we could get, anyway, for their benefit. And that was why, in due course later on, I was this lines officer at the end of all these cables that we'd put in, you see.
That was during the battle, was it, of Passchendaele?
No, it was before the battle.
Before
preparing
the battle,
for
yes.
The battle. Mm-hmm. This was probably weeks before the battle, actually. Because, you see, until now, things were going fairly well. The digging was doing quite well. It wasn't too difficult. And everybody was getting satisfied that all would be well when, as soon as the Passchendaele battle began, the rain came down and it poured and it poured, and it turned the whole place into one enormous marsh in which men actually drowned. The only way you could get through was to bring duck boards, that's what we call them. They're 10 feet long with bars across, and we'd bring duck boards, you see, and you had to stick to the duck board wherever you were going, because if you stepped off, you went straight up to your waist or beyond, you see. And so I was wandering about with this duck board business. I had to keep going to see the lines and so on. And then on my own, which was wrong, you're supposed to take someone with you, but I was on my own, and suddenly I found I was in this marsh of mud and a heavy burst of shelling started, and I thought, I'm in for trouble. Nowhere to run, but at that stage I realised there was on its side an army tank that had been hit and had disappeared into the mud almost. It was halfway in mud. And so I rushed into that, got inside, and the shells pounded on the outside, and I was safe inside, only low calibre shells. And I remember so well, I got a rather nice trench coat, and by the time I landed on the floor of this tank, where the engines had burst and covered the whole place with black oil, you can imagine, I came out there smothered with oil from head to foot, but safe, while outside they'd been bouncing off this tank and firing all around it. So that was one of my rather dangerous moments.
That must have been very difficult for your wiring job.
Oh, yes. Our cables were all right. You see, they were 4 feet down. But the surface wires were in continuous trouble. That was the big problem, hence the cable that we were laying. Because the cable was heavy stuff, you see. It was quite thick stuff, thicker than my thumb. And it came up in big coils, which had to be carried by two men with a pole between them. And they'd got to stagger all the way along these frightful duck balls to get them there. Mind you, a good deal of this was done before the rains came. When the rains came, of course, you couldn't have dug anywhere. And that's when people were floundering in the mud. Men were dying in mud, not from wounds, but by falling off the duck boards.
Did you see that yourself?
Not personally. I was out in the dark and finding my way about. But I can assure you that it was a great risk getting up through this frightful mud.
Do you remember the opening stage of that battle, Passchendaele? Were you, at the front?
I wasn't as near as that. I wasn't an infantryman anymore, you see. I was there endeavouring to try to keep the lines through to them all the while, with all the troubles that went with it.
So how far up would you have been?
Well, when I was in that was my most forward one, that one I was telling you about, where I had my nice comfortable place and so on.
Before the battle, wasn't it? Yes.
I had a great problem there, because senior gunner officers, majors and so on, would come in and demand lines from me, and I'd have to decide whether I'd let them have it or not, because otherwise they'd threaten to cut in and take them themselves. And so I had to be very severe with that, and I had a special high power line right through to the deputy signals officer, the chief there, and if I had one of these bullying majors coming in and I was a second lieutenant and saying, I'm going to have a line for my observer, whether you like it or not, sort of assigned regularly, and I say, would you like to speak to Major so-and-so? And you see by the look on the major's face, he was hearing something very unpleasant by being awkward. The danger of them robbing you of their lines is very serious. But mind you, on the other hand, they said they can't have their gunners standing by the guns and not knowing where to shoot because they'd lost their observer. It was a tragic problem for them when they were losing touch, I quite agree. But our lines helped a lot once we'd got the cables down low.
How well do you think the system held up, you know, during the worst phase of that battle, when the sort of mud set in? Were you able to keep telephone links between...
Yes, because most of these cables, which were now under mud, were still working all right. And if they reached the brigade headquarters, and that brigade headquarters was in a concrete emplacement or somewhere like that, generally speaking, what I might call the major information would get through that way. And the rest of forward of that would be lines laid on the top, which were very frequently cut by shell fire, and, of course, runners.
Yes, so I'm right in thinking that brigade would have been kept informed of what was happening in that section of the front.
That's right, brigade would be this point, yeah.
Yes, sort of front line position.
That's right, we're all going like that into it. Then from the brigade, you see these cable lines right the way through back here.
Yes.
And a division, and we've got a signals officer division, and there it comes in there.
Yes, but I suppose communication within the front line might have been more difficult with the wiring system. Am I right?
There wasn't much hope. Most of that depended more or less on the orderlies sending them poor fellows on foot. We used the dogs, we used the pigeons, all that kind of thing, but generally speaking, it was the unfortunate man had to try to get through if he could. See, there's only one communication. It's from the front line to the battalion headquarters. That's as far as they can get. And then the battalion headquarters through to the brigade.
Could you ever be overheard by the Germans? Did they have equipment to pick up your signals?
Yes, quite. We both had equipment. The result was quite ludicrous because we pushed our men right out to these special areas, and they spent all night and all day there until the next night, and they had their box with its valves in it, they had earphones, and they recorded everything they heard. Pages and pages of it, you see, all in German code. Now, this arrived at my office and was immediately shot off to the intelligence, and then they had a coding officer, and sometimes they were able to break their codes as well. But when things were going rather badly in our direction, they would come up like this, you see, a whole lot of German characters like this, and they say, what about it, Tommy, now? You see, or something like that. Rude English words being thrown back at us from the... They knew we were listening to them, and we in turn, I presume they were listening to us too. There was a tremendous amount of information got once they got these valves working, you know.
Yes, this would be interesting about the developments in the interwar period.
Yes.
When you tell me about the developments of technology, because I suppose at this stage, Arthur, it was quite crude, wasn't it? The sort of communications
it systems. Vastly improved by that, because prior to that, it was take South Africa, it was a man on horseback, or it was a man up on a hill with flags. Of course, our signals were taught to signal with flags if needed, but there was no signalling with flags in that area, because anybody standing up waving a flag about, he'd have all the German guns that could reach him would have a shot at him. No, they wouldn't do that.
So would you say then that the developments of the system and the methods in World War One, that, you know, this was noticeable, that there was considerable development in signals technology?
Well, tremendous effort. Until then, it was flags and men and horses, you see, nothing more. That was all they ever had in South Africa. Now, in the next war, you see, it got better and better. Even in, funnily enough, after the war, in my unit, I had a sergeant major who had been out in Gallipoli in the signals, and he was telling me how he ran the lines all the way around Suvla Bay. I never met him there then, He didn't know me either, and I wasn't concerned, but nevertheless, he'd also been running lines around Suvla Bay, hitching them on the trees, you see, to get them round. More communication problem. Nowadays, it's all done by wireless, of course.
You were telling me about your relationship with the Australians,
yes.
Which seems to be very good. One often hears that Australian soldiers were less disciplined than British. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. At least on one occasion, they marched out of the line, having had 10 hectic days in the line, and they were put into a small town where they immediately began to chase the women about the town and everybody else, and got themselves into such a state. And suddenly bugles were blown and the whole regiment was drawn up in the main square, and the general came down, the British general, and he told them exactly what he thought of them. He said, you've had 10 days in the line, you've been out one out of the line, and you've caused an extraordinary amount of damage and trouble in this town in this first 24 hours. About turn, Colonel marched them back again, took them back up the line. They'd only had one day out. That taught them a thing or two anyway. But that was an occasion that did occur.
How about the New Zealanders? Were they different?
Very little different. We didn't notice one from the other very much, I think. Bear in mind, we met them under line conditions when they were good soldiers, you see. Honest, hard-working, if it was digging, if it was marching, no matter what, they were very good. The only thing is that their discipline could shake at times when they got away from it. I don't mean the discipline in the line, I don't mean they were awkward there. It was when the fighting is over, that's when they want to do what they like, you see. They were much more difficult then.
You mentioned also Birdwood. Mm. What was your impression of him, General Birdwood?
Well, he was a very good general. He was a little man, and he so surprised the Australians, because they formed this corps and they gave it to Birdwood, and the people, the Australians said, haven't we got any Australian officers? No, they gave it to Birdwood. Now, in Gallipoli, he went round the trenches in Anzac, and they treated him as a friend, you see, and they said, Birdie, they called him Birdie, you see. And they had a gag going, because somebody tried this to begin with. They said, Birdie, have you got a match, you see? And so Birdwood handed him a box of matches. And they thought, this is a good show. So from then onwards, whenever he went up the line, sooner or later, one of the soldiers would turn and say, what about a box of matches, you see? And his rigid aide-de-camp had a sack of matchboxes which he had to carry around and hand over each time. Very amusing, that. He was a very nice chap, Birdwood. Oh, did I say about Birdwood coming in and knew all about pigeons? Yes, I did.
Yes,
that,
yes. Yes. You found him easy to talk to, did you?
Very charming man. He was a very likeable man. It pleased me when I was in Melbourne, living in Melbourne, that I should go every day along Birdwood Avenue, named after him. He was a good general. He was in the Chateau Fleet, F-L-E-T-E, which is the chateau in the book of the Dumas, Book of Three Nice Musketeers, was the chateau where my lady was put. Musketeers. I put that in for luck, you see. Now, I got one more about that area, if you don't mind. I was at a headquarters where the King George V was expected to come and visit. He was going around trying to, shall I say, cheer up the generals after the Battle of the Seas and so on, and he was coming along to Berber's headquarters. He was due along there about 3 o'clock, and that was in the morning we heard about it, and I said to somebody, don't you have to have a God of Honour or something, or God there? I don't know what you Limeys do about that kind of thing. We don't do much. I said, well, that won't do. Can't have that. So I went round that morning, collected together the various batmen and odd people I could find, got them to get their guns cleaned up and ready, and just before 3 o'clock I had them in two rows either side of the route up to the castle, and General Birdwood drove by, got out, walked along, looked at my troops and was satisfied with them, and I was very pleased with that. It looked better, you know. When the King arrived there, they'd got a very big gun, which they, a naval gun, which had been brought up on rails and brought into, hidden in an imitation house. They knocked down the original house in a row of old houses right near the front line and had put this gun in, and they'd put a camouflage house all around it. And at a certain hour of the day, when it was just an early evening, when they could see well and not be seen, the roof slid back and this enormous naval gun came up and they fired terrific shells out into the German line. Now, when the King was there, they said, "We would like to do a shoot for you, sir, and we think it'd be rather nice if you could actually sort of give the word to fire and we'll organise it, because there's a village. It's just back here, you can see it through the binoculars. That village has got a tall church spire in which we are quite confident they've got very good observation. And it's a bad thing for us, and we ought to knock it down. It's a little too far for most of our guns, but this big gun should get it. And would you be good enough to actually give orders for the fire of the gun each time?" And so they aimed this massive gun up, and the King said, "Fire," and they fired. And they fired 10 rounds altogether. And at the end of that, they put the field glasses up, they put the telescope up for the King to see, and the wretched tower was still standing. So they were rather nonplussed by this, but they'd done a bit of damage, I think. So the next day they sent the plane over to telephone the results. And to their surprise and satisfaction, unknown to them, was a large siege battery of big German guns hidden at the back of this church, which had been causing us a lot of trouble and had never been quite satisfactorily traced. And our big shells had done no harm to the church spire, but had blown that little lot up. And you could see that the gun pits had been thoroughly banged about by our heavy, heavy gun. The Germans themselves must have been surprised at her cleverness and having found them. Can't believe that they would expect that to happen.
King George V yourself when he made this
visit?
Oh,
yes, definitely. The King's retinue in their cars drove up, King stepped out, my parade presented arms, and he walked quietly along them without stopping and went straight in to see the general. He had a very busy day before him because he was trying to visit all the generals in the one day, so that very shortly afterwards he was out again and walked through my files into his car and away.
Do you think it's important that the King came to the front like that?
Yes. The point, of course, was that we were going through a rather difficult time. The Battle of Somme, certainly the Somme, had been a difficult one and not much of a success. And I think things were a bit down at the time. The King felt it wise to go round and encourage his generals, which he did, because everybody was glad to have been seen by him. They were able to tell him quite a lot, I expect.
Could I ask you now, you know, you've explained your part in the Battle of Passchendaele, which was, of course, the responsibility for the cables as signals officer. Did you form any sort of opinion of that battle compared with Messines?
Well, inevitably, yes. The answer is that with all our careful preparations, everything failed in that marsh, that sea of mud, which prevented everything happening, prevented the gunners to get their guns in position. In fact, it was a tragedy the whole way through. That what makes it so sad is that the Battle of Messines in good weather was a success and was a limited battle which was to stop at a certain line, which we did. And when we stopped at that certain line, there were no Germans actually in front of us, except when they took their guns away. Now, you could have gone on for another mile by the look of it anyway, but there were no plans to do so. There were no troops to do so at that moment. We sort of go plow straight through. But Passchendaele, unfortunately, when we read what Sir Douglas Haig intended, was to be a breakthrough with cavalry, with everything following, to take us right through to the Dutch coast. And that was his plan, and that was what Passchendaele was designed to do. And that was where we were completely and utterly beaten by the appalling conditions by which guns could not get up, troops could not get there, nothing could work. The whole thing was a flop in that way.
Where were you in March 1918 when the Germans made their push through? Were you in France then?
Yes. After, when I was eventually found in the Australians, I had to go to the colonel of the signals side and tell him that I'd been lost for many months and wasn't it time that somebody found me. And he was good enough to make arrangements to have me moved out from the signals, and I found myself in due course working my way up to the 5th Army headquarters. And I was made... There were three signal masters through the 24 hours, and I was one of the three signal masters of the 5th Army. That's the British Army, of course. That was the end of my Australian venture, which must have lasted just about a year, I suppose. And all these interesting things happened to me.
When you were with the 5th Army, whereabouts, what part of the line would you have been in with the 5th Army?
By the time I reached the 5th Army, the war was finishing, and we fought our way, while I was there, we fought our way into Lille. I knew the subaltern of the first group of infantrymen coming in, and they came up towards the Lille gate in the ditch, creeping along carefully, watching every move. And out from the gate came a young English girl who'd been trapped in Lille at the beginning of the war and had been under the Germans there the whole time. And she was walking down the road and saying, "Do come out of the ditch, you foolish fellows. The Germans have gone out the other side." She'd seen the Germans depart, and of course we were being very careful in going in. But she was made a lot of fuss on. The newspapers made a fuss. I've forgotten her name now. But she was a charming girl, but she'd gone out there to act as a nanny to a French family and got caught by the Germans arriving, and so she spent the whole of the war under German domination. And she could tell us a lot about it too then.
Where were you when the armistice was declared?
I was in Lille then as the 5th Army signal master. I was in the signals mess there, and First we drove down the streets saying, you know, armistice, armistice, and then we went back to the mess, and then we sat in a circle all round, thoroughly miserable. And what shall we do now? We've all got to go back, got no work to go to, some of them. I don't want to go back. You know, we were thoroughly upset. It was the most miserable evening. We sat there like that, and then finally all went to bed. Well, that's that. I mean, how could we be happy, being all that war, getting to a comfortable place like Lille, and then then that to happen to us? We were in a beautiful house, too. It had been the Germans' headquarters all the while, with beautiful flowers and everything around us, and there was no time to leave it. In fact, we didn't leave for some time.
While you were advancing, you know, with the 5th Army, what was your signals job with them? What were you doing exactly?
Well, let me see now. Well, you see, I have to watch my memory now. I worked every day with them. I went out with them when they were laying lines or when they were connecting up telephones somewhere. But I'm trying to remember whether I did anything much. I must have done something. Although, mind you, as I was telling you, I was for some time the signal master's, I mean the colonel's secretary. But it was after the colonel had gone that I found I was more or less on my own amongst the Australians. We were very nice and friendly. I liked them all, but I felt something ought to be done for me. I think they were beginning to wonder what to do with me as well, because they were just giving me jobs to do, you know.
Did you have any leave, any blighty leave?
I did indeed. I had one leave. It was wonderful. I came straight home and I rang up the ticket agency and I booked every seat that I could get in every theatre show there was. Not, most of all, Chu Chin Chow. That's what I wanted. Then I rang up lady friends that I'd got around, and they all agreed, and so I took them out in the evening, out to dinner and out to a different theatre each night, and really made the best of that. And of course, when we went back and took records back, and you had the gramophone records for the officers' mess, and I certainly remember that leave. I think that was the only big leave I had. I think after that I might have got a short one during the armistice period, but not so exciting as that one was.
Do you think when you returned home to Blighty on leave, that the people there really understood what the war was like? Did you get any
impression? I don't know which way to answer that, because they only read the newspapers, they only read all soldiers were gallant and nobody was a coward and all that kind of thing, and I don't think they appreciated. They either, some of them really felt and realised that it was a terrible state of affairs, and others were so put off by Bairn's father's drawings and the various humorous stories of the trenches that you think it was one gay party. And there's an attitude almost of, well, you were lucky to be in the trenches, you were being fed while we were here, you know, we can't get any more meat or something like that. No, people at home were extraordinarily ignorant. But mind you, if the Second World War was the real answer, because they really felt they were suffering just as much as any of the soldiers with all that bombing. But see, as far as we're concerned, we'd only had Zeppelin raids, and as you know, they were only a flea bite compared with the dangerous raids afterwards.
You were comparing Gallipoli with France earlier on, you know, when we looked at Gallipoli at the end of that. I didn't actually ask you about the sort of food situation in France then. Were you getting good rations?
Oh yes, the food, was pretty well organised. It was the where it was back in the support lines, or you know, fine, not in the front lines, they could have Dixies cooking on open fires and so on, and you could get a hot sort of boiled meat dish quite often. You got bread, quite good bread. You could get quite a number of normal things that one would enjoy, I suppose. I'm trying to remember, because you've got to bear in mind now, we're talking about an officer. And of course, officer's life, there was a different one altogether. But is this a moment when we can talk about that? Well, I, being a young officer on arrival at the new headquarters, was told that I was to be the mess secretary, and that I was in charge of the cook and the cookhouse. So I went to see the cook. To my astonishment, a charming man, apparently a good cook, but must have been educated at a very good school, because he was a most educated, interesting man, spoke beautifully too. And the first dinner in the mess that I was taking over, I was pleased to note what happened was that he marched in and put a nicely roasted chicken in front of the major. He then came back and he brought a dish of green peas, and then he brought another dish of new potatoes. And the major, rather, who was a senior there, seemed quite pleased with this, and he congratulated me on the success of my taking over. So I went out to see Private Morton and to ask him how this had all happened. I said, I didn't understand we bought that kind of thing. He said, sir, if I go for an early morning walk about 6 and I see a missing chicken walking about with no owner, and if there's somebody left a place there with peas and potatoes not being touched, he said, the only thing to do is to bring some back. I look after the cooking, sir. You look after the bills. Well, then I found that I don't know what he could have been in private life. I think he must have been a very superior burglar or something like that, because he, whenever I took him into Saint-Omer, which was our headquarters town, whenever I took him there shopping, Morton always accompanied me with a sandbag in his arm. And when I wasn't looking, I'd find him slipping things in the shop in there without me knowing, all of which I had to stop. Sometimes I'd stop him outside of the shop and send him back to put them back, which he would do with great apologies to the chap and say it was all a mistake, you know, literally. On one occasion in particular, we were going to drive in, and on our route we stopped at the mineral water area in which they made mineral water for the troops and for the officers, and I was to pick